Many scholars argue that the voyages of Admiral Zheng He of the Chinese Ming dynasty heralded and eclipsed the European voyages of discovery. Between 1405 and 1433, Zheng led seven huge armadas from China to the far reaches of the Indian Ocean. The largest of these comprised almost 300 ships and carried close to 30,000 people. They visited Indonesia, Sri Lanka, India, the Persian Gulf, the Red Sea, and East Africa. Chinese ships anchored in Jeddah, the main harbor of the Hejaz, and in Malindi on the Kenyan coast. Columbus' fleet of 1492, which consisted of three small ships manned by 120 sailors, was like a trio of mosquitoes compared to Zheng He's drove of dragons. Yet there was a crucial difference. Zheng He explored the oceans and assisted pro-Chinese rulers, but he did not try to conquer or colonize the countries he visited. Moreover, the expeditions of Zheng He were not deeply rooted in Chinese politics and culture. When the ruling faction in Beijing changed during the 1430s, the new overlords abruptly terminated the operation. The Great Fleet was dismantled, crucial technical and geographical knowledge was lost, and no explorer of such stature and means ever set out again from a Chinese port. Chinese rulers in the coming centuries, like most Chinese rulers in previous centuries, restricted their interests and ambitions to the Middle Kingdom's immediate environs. The Zheng He expeditions prove that Europe did not enjoy an outstanding technological edge. What made Europeans exceptional was their unparalleled and insatiable ambition to explore and conquer. Although they might have had the ability, the Romans never attempted to conquer India or Scandinavia, the Persians never attempted to conquer Madagascar or Spain, and the Chinese never attempted to conquer Indonesia or Africa. Most Chinese rulers left even nearby Japan to its own devices. There was nothing peculiar about that. The oddity is that early modern Europeans caught a fever that drove them to sail to distant and completely unknown lands full of alien cultures, take one step onto their beaches, and immediately declare, "I claim all these territories for my king." Invasion from outer space. Around 1517, Spanish colonists in the Caribbean islands began to hear vague rumors about a powerful empire somewhere in the center of the Mexican mainland. A mere 4 years later, the Aztec capital was a smoldering ruin, the Aztec Empire was a thing of the past, and Hernán Cortés lorded over a vast new Spanish empire in Mexico. The Spaniards did not stop to congratulate themselves or even to catch their breath. They immediately commenced explore and conquer operations in all directions. The previous rulers of Central America, the Aztecs, the Toltecs, the Maya, barely knew South America existed and never made any attempt to subjugate it over the course of 2,000 years. Yet, within little more than 10 years of the Spanish conquest of Mexico, Francisco Pizarro had discovered the Inca Empire in South America, vanquishing it in 1532. Had the Aztecs and Incas shown a bit more interest in the world surrounding them, and had they known what the Spaniards had done to their neighbors, they might have resisted the Spanish conquest more keenly and successfully. In the years separating Columbus' first journey to America, 1492, from the landing of Cortés in Mexico, 1519, the Spaniards conquered most of the Caribbean islands, setting up a chain of new colonies. For the subjugated natives, these colonies were hell on earth. They were ruled with an iron fist by greedy and unscrupulous colonists who enslaved them and set them to work in mines and plantations, killing anyone who offered the slightest resistance. Most of the native population soon died, either because of the harsh working conditions or the virulence of the diseases that hitchhiked to America on the conquerors' sailing ships. Within 20 years, almost the entire native Caribbean population was wiped out. The Spanish colonists began importing African slaves to fill the vacuum. This genocide took place on the very doorstep of the Aztec Empire, yet when Cortés landed on the empire's eastern coasts, the Aztecs knew nothing about it. The coming of the Spaniards was the equivalent of an alien invasion from outer space. The Aztecs were convinced that they knew the entire world and that they ruled most of it. To them it was unimaginable that outside their domain could exist anything like these Spaniards. When Cortes and his men landed on the sunny beaches of today's Veracruz, it was the first time the Aztecs encountered a completely unknown people. The Aztecs did not know how to react. They had trouble deciding what these strangers were. Unlike all known humans, the aliens had white skins. They also had lots of facial hair. Some had hair the color of the sun. They stank horribly. Native hygiene was far better than Spanish hygiene. When the Spaniards first arrived in Mexico, natives bearing incense burners were assigned to accompany them wherever they went. The Spaniards thought it was a mark of divine honor. We know from native sources that they found the newcomers' smell unbearable. The aliens' material culture was even more bewildering. They came in giant ships, the like of which the Aztecs had never imagined, let alone seen. They rode on the back of huge and terrifying animals, swift as the wind. They could produce lightning and thunder out of shiny metal sticks. They had flashing long swords and impenetrable armor, against which the natives' wooden swords and flint spears were useless. Some Aztecs thought these must be gods. Others argued that they were demons or the ghosts of the dead or powerful sorcerers. Instead of concentrating all available forces and wiping out the Spaniards, the Aztecs deliberated, dawdled, and negotiated. They saw no reason to rush. After all, Cortes had no more than 550 Spaniards with him. What could 550 men do to an empire of millions? Cortes was equally ignorant about the Aztecs, but he and his men held significant advantages over their adversaries. While the Aztecs had no experience to prepare them for the arrival of these strange-looking and foul-smelling aliens, the Spaniards knew that the earth was full of unknown human realms, and no one had greater expertise in invading alien lands and dealing with situations about which they were utterly ignorant. For the modern European conqueror, like the modern European scientist, plunging into the unknown was exhilarating. So when Cortes anchored off that sunny beach in July 1519, he did not hesitate to act. Like a science fiction alien emerging from his spaceship, he declared to the awestruck locals, "We come in peace. Take us to your leader." Cortes explained that he was a peaceful emissary from the great king of Spain and asked for a diplomatic interview with the Aztec ruler Montezuma II. This was a shameless lie. Cortes led an independent expedition of greedy adventurers. The king of Spain had never heard of Cortes, nor of the Aztecs. Cortes was given guides, food, and some military assistance by local enemies of the Aztecs. He then marched towards the Aztec capital, the great metropolis of Tenochtitlan. The Aztecs allowed the aliens to march all the way to the capital, then respectfully led the aliens' leader to meet Emperor Montezuma. In the middle of the interview, Cortes gave a signal, and steel-armed Spaniards butchered Montezuma's bodyguards, who were armed only with wooden clubs and stone blades. The honored guest took his host prisoner. Cortes was now in a very delicate situation. He had captured the emperor, but was surrounded by tens of thousands of furious enemy warriors, millions of hostile civilians, and an entire continent about which he knew practically nothing. He had at his disposal only a few hundred Spaniards, and the closest Spanish reinforcements were in Cuba, more than 1,000 miles away. Cortes kept Montezuma captive in the palace, making it look as if the king remained free and in charge, and as if the Spanish ambassador were no more than a guest. The Aztec Empire was an extremely centralized polity, and this unprecedented situation paralyzed it. Montezuma continued to behave as if he ruled the empire, and the Aztec elite continued to obey him, which meant they obeyed Cortes. This situation lasted for several months, during which time Cortes interrogated Montezuma and his attendants, trained translators in a variety of local languages, and sent small Spanish expeditions in all directions to become familiar with the Aztec Empire and the various tribes, peoples, and cities that it ruled. The Aztec elite eventually revolted against Cortes and Montezuma, elected a new emperor, and drove the Spaniards from Tenochtitlan. However, by now numerous cracks had appeared in the imperial edifice. Cortes used the knowledge he had gained to prise the cracks open wider and split the empire from within. he convinced many of the empire's subject peoples to join him against the ruling Aztec elite. The subject peoples miscalculated badly. They hated the Aztecs, but knew nothing of Spain or the Caribbean genocide. They assumed that with Spanish help they could shake off the Aztec yoke. The idea that the Spanish would take over never occurred to them. They were sure that if Cortes and his few hundred henchmen caused any trouble, they could easily be overwhelmed. The rebellious peoples provided Cortes with an army of tens of thousands of local troops, and with its help, Cortes besieged Tenochtitlan and conquered the city. At this stage, more and more Spanish soldiers and settlers began arriving in Mexico, some from Cuba, others all the way from Spain. When the local peoples realized what was happening, it was too late. Within a century of the landing at Veracruz, the native population of the Americas had shrunk by about 90%, due mainly to unfamiliar diseases that reached America with the invaders. The survivors found themselves under the thumb of a greedy and racist regime that was far worse than that of the Aztecs. 10 years after Cortes landed in Mexico, Pizarro arrived on the shore of the Inca Empire. He had far fewer soldiers than Cortes. His expedition numbered just 168 men. Yet Pizarro benefited from all the knowledge and experience gained in previous invasions. The Inca, in contrast, knew nothing about the fate of the Aztecs. Pizarro plagiarized Cortes. He declared himself a peaceful emissary from the King of Spain, invited the Inca ruler, Atahualpa, to a diplomatic interview, and then kidnapped him. Pizarro proceeded to conquer the paralyzed empire with the help of local allies. If the subject peoples of the Inca Empire had known the fate of the inhabitants of Mexico, they would not have thrown in their lot with the invaders. But they did not know. The native peoples of America were not the only ones to pay a heavy price for their parochial outlook. The great empires of Asia, the Ottoman, the Safavid, the Mughal, and the Chinese, very quickly heard that the Europeans had discovered something big. Yet they displayed little interest in these discoveries. They continued to believe that the world revolved around Asia, and made no attempt to compete with the Europeans for control of America or of the new ocean lanes in the Atlantic and the Pacific. Even puny European kingdoms, such as Scotland and Denmark, sent a few explore and conquer expeditions to America, but not one expedition of either exploration or conquest was ever sent to America from the Islamic world, India, or China. The first non-European power that tried to send a military expedition to America was Japan. That happened in June 1942, when a Japanese expedition conquered Kiska and Attu, two small islands off the Alaskan coast, capturing in the process 10 U.S. soldiers and a dog. The Japanese never got any closer to the mainland. It is hard to argue that the Ottomans or Chinese were too far away, or that they lacked the technological, economic, or military wherewithal. The resources that sent Zheng He from China to East Africa in the 1420s should have been enough to reach America. The Chinese just weren't interested. The first Chinese world map to show America was not issued until 1602, and then by a European missionary. For 300 years, Europeans enjoyed undisputed mastery in America and Oceania, in the Atlantic and the Pacific. The only significant struggles in those regions were between different European powers. The wealth and resources accumulated by the Europeans eventually enabled them to invade Asia too, defeat its empires, and divide it among themselves. When the Ottomans, Persians, Indians, and Chinese woke up and began paying attention, it was too late. Only in the 20th century did non-European cultures adopt a truly global vision. This was one of the crucial factors that led to the collapse of European hegemony. Thus, in the Algerian War of Independence, 1954-62, Algerian guerrillas defeated a French army with an overwhelming numerical, technological, and economic advantage. The Algerians prevailed because they were supported by a global anti-colonial network, and because they worked out how to harness the world's media to their cause, as well as public opinion in France itself. The defeat that little North Vietnam inflicted on the American colossus was based on a similar strategy. These guerrilla forces showed that even superpowers could be defeated if a local struggle became a global cause. It is interesting to contemplate what might have happened had Montezuma been able to manipulate public opinion in Spain and gain assistance from one of Spain's rivals, Portugal, France, or the Ottoman Empire. Rare spiders and forgotten scripts. Modern science and modern empires were motivated by the restless feeling that perhaps something important awaited beyond the horizon, something they had better explore and master. Yet the connection between science and empire went much deeper. Not just the motivation, but also the practices of empire builders were entangled with those of scientists. For modern Europeans, building an empire was a scientific project, while setting up a scientific discipline was an imperial project. When the Muslims conquered India, they did not bring along archaeologists to systematically study Indian history, anthropologists to study Indian cultures, geologists to study Indian soils, or zoologists to study Indian fauna. When the British conquered India, they did all of these things. On 10 April 1802, the Great Survey of India was launched. It lasted 60 years. With the help of tens of thousands of native labourers, scholars, and guides, the British carefully mapped the whole of India, marking borders, measuring distances, and even calculating for the first time the exact height of Mount Everest and the other Himalayan peaks. The British explored the military resources of Indian provinces and the location of their gold mines, but they also took the trouble to collect information about rare Indian spiders, to catalogue colourful butterflies, to trace the ancient origins of extinct Indian languages, and to dig up forgotten ruins. Mohenjo-Daro was one of the chief cities of the Indus Valley civilization, which flourished in the 3rd millennium BC and was destroyed around 1900 BC. None of India's pre-British rulers, neither the Mauryas, nor the Guptas, nor the Delhi Sultans, nor the great Mughals, had given the ruins a second glance. But a British archaeological survey took notice of the site in 1922. A British team then excavated it and discovered the first great civilization of India, which no Indian had been aware of. Another telling example of British scientific curiosity was the deciphering of cuneiform script. This was the main script used throughout the Middle East for close to 3,000 years, but the last person able to read it probably died sometime in the early 1st millennium AD. Since then, inhabitants of the region frequently encountered cuneiform inscriptions on monuments, steles, ancient ruins, and broken pots. But they had no idea how to read the weird angular scratches, and as far as we know, they never tried. Cuneiform came to the attention of Europeans in 1618, when the Spanish ambassador in Persia went sightseeing in the ruins of ancient Persepolis, where he saw inscriptions that nobody could explain to him. News of the unknown script spread among European savants and piqued their curiosity. In 1657, European scholars published the first transcription of a cuneiform text from Persepolis. More and more transcriptions followed, and for close to two centuries, scholars in the West tried to decipher them. None succeeded. In the 1830s, a British officer named Henry Rawlinson was sent to Persia to help the Shah train his army in the European style. In his spare time, Rawlinson travelled around Persia, and one day he was led by local guides to a cliff in the Zagros Mountains and shown the huge Behistun inscription. About 50 feet high and 80 feet wide, it had been etched high up on the cliff face on the command of King Darius I sometime around 500 BC. It was written in cuneiform script in three languages, Old Persian, Elamite, and Babylonian. The inscription was well known to the local population, but nobody could read it. Rawlinson became convinced that if he could decipher the writing, it would enable him and other scholars to read the numerous inscriptions and texts that were at the time being discovered all over the Middle East, opening a door into an ancient and forgotten world. The first step in deciphering the lettering was to produce an accurate transcription that could be sent back to Europe. Rawlinson defied death to do so, scaling the steep cliff to copy the strange letters. He hired several locals to help him, most notably a Kurdish boy who climbed to the most inaccessible parts of the cliff in order to copy the upper portion of the inscription. In 1847, the project was completed, and a full and accurate copy was sent to Europe. Rawlinson did not rest on his laurels. As an army officer, he had military and political missions to carry out, but whenever he had a spare moment, he puzzled over the secret script. He tried one method after another, and finally managed to decipher the Old Persian part of the inscription. This was easiest, since Old Persian was not that different from modern Persian, which Rawlinson knew well. An understanding of the Old Persian section gave him the key he needed to unlock the secrets of the Elamite and Babylonian sections. The great door swung open, and out came a rush of ancient but lively voices. The bustle of Sumerian bazaars, the proclamations of Assyrian kings, the arguments of Babylonian bureaucrats. Without the efforts of modern European imperialists such as Rawlinson, we would not have known much about the fate of the ancient Middle Eastern empires. Another notable imperialist scholar was William Jones. Jones arrived in India in September 1783 to serve as a judge in the Supreme Court of Bengal. He was so captivated by the wonders of India that within less than 6 months of his arrival, he had founded the Asiatic Society. This academic organization was devoted to studying the cultures, histories, and societies of Asia, and in particular those of India. Within 2 years, Jones published his observations on the Sanskrit language, which pioneered the science of comparative linguistics. In his publications, Jones pointed out surprising similarities between Sanskrit, an ancient Indian language that became the sacred tongue of Hindu ritual, and the Greek and Latin languages, as well as similarities between all these languages and Gothic, Celtic, Old Persian, German, French, and English. Thus, in Sanskrit, mother is mater, in Latin it is mater, and in Old Celtic it is mathir. Jones surmised that all these languages must share a common origin, developing from a now-forgotten ancient ancestor. He was thus the first to identify what later came to be called the Indo-European family of languages. Jones' study was an important milestone, not merely due to his bold and accurate hypotheses, but also because of the orderly methodology that he developed to compare languages. It was adopted by other scholars, enabling them systematically to study the development of all the world's languages. Linguistics received enthusiastic imperial support. The European empires believed that in order to govern effectively, they must know the languages and cultures of their subjects. British officers arriving in India were supposed to spend up to 3 years in a Calcutta college, where they studied Hindu and Muslim law alongside English law, Sanskrit, Urdu, and Persian alongside Greek and Latin, and Tamil, Bengali, and Hindustani culture alongside mathematics, economics, and geography. The study of linguistics provided invaluable help in understanding the structure and grammar of local languages. Thanks to the work of people like William Jones and Henry Rawlinson, the European conquerors knew their empires very well. Far better indeed than any previous conquerors, or even the native population itself. Their superior knowledge had obvious practical advantages. Without such knowledge, it is unlikely that a ridiculously small number of Britons could have succeeded in governing, oppressing, and exploiting so many hundreds of millions of Indians for 2 centuries. Throughout the 19th and early 20th centuries, fewer than 5,000 British officials, about 40,000 to 70,000 British soldiers, and perhaps another 100,000 British business people, hangers-on, wives, and children, were sufficient to conquer and rule up to 300 million Indians. Yet these practical advantages were not the only reason why empires financed the study of linguistics, botany, geography, and history. No less important was the fact that science gave the empires ideological justification. Modern Europeans came to believe that acquiring new knowledge was always good. The fact that the empires produced a constant stream of new knowledge branded them as progressive and positive enterprises. Even today, histories of sciences, such as geography, archaeology, and botany, cannot avoid crediting the European empires, at least indirectly. Histories of botany have little to say about the suffering of the Aboriginal Australians, but they usually find some kind words for James Cook and Joseph Banks. Furthermore, the new knowledge accumulated by the empires made it possible, at least in theory, to benefit the conquered populations and bring them the benefits of progress, to provide them with medicine and education, to build railroads and canals, to ensure justice and prosperity. Imperialists claimed that their empires were not vast enterprises of exploitation, but rather altruistic projects conducted for the sake of the non-European races. In Rudyard Kipling's words, the white man's burden. Take up the white man's burden, send forth the best ye breed, go bind your sons to exile, to serve your captive's need, to wait in heavy harness on fluttered folk and wild, your new court sullen peoples, half devil and half child. Of course, the facts often belied this myth. The British conquered Bengal, the richest province of India, in 1764. The new rulers were interested in little except enriching themselves. They adopted a disastrous economic policy that a few years later led to the outbreak of the Great Bengal Famine. It began in 1769, reached catastrophic levels in 1770, and lasted until 1773. About 10 million Bengalis, a third of the province's population, died in the calamity. In truth, neither the narrative of oppression and exploitation nor that of the white man's burden completely matches the facts. The European empires did so many different things on such a large scale that you can find plenty of examples to support whatever you want to say about them. You think that these empires were evil monstrosities that spread death, oppression, and injustice around the world? You could easily fill an encyclopedia with their crimes. You want to argue that they in fact improved the conditions of their subjects with new medicines, better economic conditions, and greater security? You could fill another encyclopedia with their achievements. Due to their close cooperation with science, these empires wielded so much power and changed the world to such an extent that perhaps they cannot be simply labeled as good or evil. They created the world as we know it, including the ideologies we use in order to judge them. But science was also used by imperialists to more sinister ends. Biologists, anthropologists, and even linguists provided scientific proof that Europeans are superior to all other races and consequently have the right, if not perhaps the duty, to rule over them. After William Jones argued that all Indo-European languages descend from a single ancient language, many scholars were eager to discover who the speakers of that language had been. They noticed that the earliest Sanskrit speakers, who had invaded India from Central Asia more than 3,000 years ago, had called themselves Arya. The speakers of the earliest Persian language called themselves Arya. European scholars consequently surmised that the people who spoke the primordial language that gave birth to both Sanskrit and Persian, as well as to Greek, Latin, Gothic, and Celtic, must have called themselves Aryans. Could it be a coincidence that those who founded the magnificent Indian, Persian, Greek, and Roman civilizations were all Aryans? Next, British, French, and German scholars wedded the linguistic theory about the industrious Aryans to Darwin's theory of natural selection, and posited that the Aryans were not just a linguistic group, but a biological entity, a race. And not just any race, but a master race of tall, light-haired, blue-eyed, hard-working, and super-rational humans who emerged from the mists of the north to lay the foundations of culture throughout the world. Regrettably, the Aryans who invaded India and Persia intermarried with the local natives they found in these lands, losing their light complexions and blonde hair, and with them their rationality and diligence. The civilizations of India and Persia consequently declined. In Europe, on the other hand, the Aryans preserved their racial purity. This is why Europeans had managed to conquer the world, and why they were fit to rule it, provided they took precautions not to mix with inferior races. Such racist theories, prominent and respectable for many decades, have become anathema among scientists and politicians alike. People continue to conduct a heroic struggle against racism without noticing that the battlefront has shifted and that the place of racism in imperial ideology has now been replaced by culturism. There is no such word, but it's about time we coined it. Among today's elites, assertions about the contrasting merits of diverse human groups are almost always couched in terms of historical differences between cultures, rather than biological differences between races. We no longer say, it's in their blood. We say, it's in their culture. Thus, European right-wing parties, which oppose Muslim immigration, usually take care to avoid racial terminology. Marine Le Pen's speechwriters would have been shown the door on the spot had they suggested that the leader of France's Front National party go on television to declare that we don't want those inferior Semites to dilute our Aryan blood and spoil our Aryan civilization. Instead, the French Front National, the Dutch Party for Freedom, the Alliance for the Future of Austria, and their like, tend to argue that Western culture, as it has evolved in Europe, is characterized by democratic values, tolerance, and gender equality, whereas Muslim culture, which evolved in the Middle East, is characterized by hierarchical politics, fanaticism, and misogyny. Since the two cultures are so different, and since many Muslim immigrants are unwilling, and perhaps unable, to adopt Western values, they should not be allowed to enter, lest they foment internal conflict and corrode European democracy and liberalism. Such culturist arguments are fed by scientific studies in the humanities and social sciences that highlight the so-called clash of civilizations and the fundamental differences between different cultures. Not all historians and anthropologists accept these theories or support their political usages. But whereas biologists today have an easy time disavowing racism, simply explaining that the biological differences between present-day human populations are trivial, it is harder for historians and anthropologists to disavow culturism. After all, if the differences between human cultures are trivial, why should we pay historians and anthropologists to study them? Scientists have provided the Imperial Project with practical knowledge, ideological justification, and technological gadgets. Without this contribution, it is highly questionable whether Europeans could have conquered the world. The conquerors returned the favor by providing scientists with information and protection, supporting all kinds of strange and fascinating projects, and spreading the scientific way of thinking to the far corners of the earth. Without imperial support, it is doubtful whether modern science would have progressed very far. There are very few scientific disciplines that did not begin their lives as servants to imperial growth, and that do not owe a large proportion of their discoveries, collections, buildings, and scholarships to the generous help of army officers, navy captains, and imperial governors. This is obviously not the whole story. Science was supported by other institutions, not just by empires. And the European empires rose and flourished thanks also to factors other than science. Behind the meteoric rise of both science and empire lurks one particularly important force: capitalism. Were it not for businessmen seeking to make money, Columbus would not have reached America, James Cook would not have reached Australia, and Neil Armstrong would never have taken that small step on the surface of the moon.